From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Russia's biggest protests in years broke out across the country Sunday, coast to coast, from the Baltic to the Pacific, against corruption. Police moved in pretty hard. Lots of arrests. The protest leader is in jail. At a time when the U.S. president has held up Vladimir Putin as an exemplary leader and his team is under investigation for colluding with Russia, Americans are paying a little more attention. This hour, On Point, protests in Russia and what they mean. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How are you thinking these days about Vladimir Putin and the U.S. relationship with Russia? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll look at growing calls for House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes to recuse himself from the House investigation into allegations of Russian interference and Trump team collusion in the 2016 presidential election. But first, Russian protest. There was lots of it this weekend. Here's the sound of protesters in Moscow for a massive anti-corruption demonstration on Sunday, chanting in Russian, "Putin is thief."
Putin war! Putin war! Putin war! Putin war!
And here, a woman in the crowd on Moscow telling the BBC she finds corruption in Russia overwhelming. She's worried about future generations.
It's hard to live in corruption atmosphere. I have children, grandchildren, and I can't breathe in this.
I can't breathe in this. Let's go to Moscow. Jake Rudnitsky, Moscow reporter for Bloomberg News, joins us. He was at Sunday's demonstration in the Russian capital. Jake, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. We're reading tens of thousands, maybe 60,000, more or less, across the country out in the streets, and it's been a while, and corruption was the focus of the protests. How did this suddenly emerge, erupt, Jake?
Well, what this is all about is an upcoming presidential election next March in Russia, and the opposition is already trying to mobilize, led by this very charismatic 40-year-old Alexei Navalny. And Navalny's main trick is that he's very great about exposing corruption. And the kind of Ernst Weil reason for Sunday's protests was this YouTube video he put out about Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently prime minister. Your guests also might recall that he was president for 4 years,
sure,
between 2008 and 2012, when Putin constitutionally was not allowed to continue on as president. Now, Navalny put out this really amazing, damning video about that details Medvedev's, these properties that he alleges Medvedev owns around Russia. He found everything from, Medvedev placing orders for, hip new Nike shoes and, plaid T-shirts that Medvedev was later seen wearing in Instagram photos to a Tuscan villa. So, it really was a broad and very thoroughly investigated report that went viral the instant it came out. Last I checked, it had 14 million YouTube views. So what Navalny has really managed to do is kind of bypass the heavy-handed Russian state control over media. You know, if you turn on the TV, you would never hear Navalny's name even mentioned. And yet somehow he's managed to get this very large following. Mainly what you saw in the protests this weekend was that it was really a lot of kids. I mean, you had 16-year-olds. There was one picture, it looked like a kid who was maybe 13-year-old getting arrested by a riot cop. And so suddenly, I think the Kremlin's starting to take notice, because this is a demographic that the Kremlin hasn't really figured out how to speak to in their with their kind of conventional propaganda that they use.
Here's a little clip from that video, which has gone viral, kind of documentary about Russian corruption has gone viral right across the country. Alexei Navalny, an opposition leader who arrested on Sunday, now in jail for a couple of weeks. If you want to see the whole thing with English subtitles, it's at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's listen just a little. Alleges corruption in particular by Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev.
Бывший президент, действующий премьер-министр, лидер правящей партии.
He says here the former president, current prime minister, the leader of the ruling United Russia Party has created a corrupt network of charity foundations he uses to receive bribes from the oligarchs. Spends this money to build himself palaces and dachas all across the country like some kind of maniac, it says here. He also buys yachts and medieval castles abroad. He's not even really hiding because thousands of people are engaged in servicing Medvedev and his real estate. Jake Rudnitsky is with Bloomberg News and joins us from Moscow. How conscious? I mean, that's pretty high tier. And of course, we've all heard about the fortunes of billions, many billions in the case of allegedly in the case of Vladimir Putin that are out there. But in their everyday lives, is corruption a big deal in Russia, Jake?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think one of the reasons that Navalny has had such great success is corruption is the one thing that unites Russians, and everybody's got experiences with it. If you want to send your kid to kindergarten, you have to pay a bribe. If you get pulled over by the cops for speeding, it's a lot easier to just put a few rubles in a billfold and hand it to the cop than it is to go through the process of getting an official ticket. So corruption is something that Russians from all walks of life and in all across from in, you know, the 9 time zones of Russia have experience with and can identify with. And so it doesn't take much of a stretch for them to then see, you know, these kind of snarky videos that Navalny puts out. I don't want to be reductive because they're actually very thoroughly researched, but they're also very tongue-in-cheek and very biting. So these are traits that Russians see in their day-to-day lives, you know, this corruption, only it's done on such a scale or alleged on such a scale that it doesn't cease to shock Russians. I mean, it really, you know, some of these estates, they're, you know, like 50,000 square feet estates with, you know, in the middle of, you know, with huge vineyards and it's not just one of them either. You know, there's
palaces, really. It's been some years, Jake, since we've seen significant protests in the streets of Russia. Why? And what was the Kremlin's reaction? We saw pretty tough pictures of police moving in pretty hard against protesters. We heard of hundreds of arrests there. Why so long with protests? And what about the Kremlin's reaction?
Well, so the last real protests were when Putin decided what they called castling, when he had been prime minister to avoid the term limits, and then decided to come back as president. And a lot of people thought that, you know, up till that point had been happy with Putin's rule and thought he had done, you know, a decent job. The country had definitely become much more stable and wealthy under the first 12 years or so of Putin's rule. But when Putin announced that he was coming back and for a 6-year term in 2011, the middle classes, especially in Moscow and Petersburg, rejected that and hit the streets. And that was the first time that there was any real protest movement. Now, for a while, the Kremlin tolerated it, but then by 2012, they really clamped down. And when they clamped down hard. It wasn't just throwing people in jail for a few days, like currently, you know, Navalny will serve 15 days in prison. Navalny's deputy will be in jail for 10 days, and there are a few other people who are kind of caught up in the sweep who are still in jail. But it hasn't been very harsh. In 2012, they sentenced people who were really, you know, kind of, they were part of the protests but hadn't really done anything too outrageous. One guy, I think, was sentenced to several years in jail for throwing a lemon at a riot policeman. They really stamped down. And now the question is, and I think there's a real fear among the opposition that you're going to see similar, really, really harsh sentences for people who didn't really do anything except for show up.
What about the other cases we've heard about in the last week or so? The guy who's given the Putin government trouble, who supposedly fell out of his window moving a jacuzzi, Nikolai Gorokhov.
Right. This is Nikolai Gorokhov, and he was the lawyer for Sergei Magnitsky, who also died in prison trying to pursue official corruption in a scheme that he said had moved hundreds of millions, had stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from.
Right. And then you also had Denis Voronenkov, who was shot and killed in Kiev in Ukraine within the last week. I mean, does this fit into a pattern of opponents who actually, you know, I don't know, get tossed out of windows, get shot dead?
Certainly, there's a long trail of bodies of people who opposed Putin. And this Denis Voronenkov, he had been a member of parliament, and he was a communist member of parliament. Of course, in Russia, the parties don't really mean anything because all the parties kind of compete to satisfy Putin more. And he had been married to a United Russia deputy in this kind of grand ceremony. And then they fell out of favor and fled to Ukraine and suddenly became opposition. In fact, Voronenkov, this Denis Voronenkov, he had been the subject when he fled to Ukraine of a vicious Navalny video where Navalny was accusing mm-hmm. him of being just as corrupt as everybody else. But that didn't stop him from getting shot. He had been cooperating with the Ukrainian authorities to build a case against the former president, Viktor Yanukovych, who has fled to Russia and was kind of the instigation of the Euromaidan revolution in Ukraine that has now put in a kind of more Western-friendly power in Ukraine.
When you look at this whole picture, Jake, and meanwhile back in the States, we have investigations going on about potential collusion, FBI investigating potential Trump team collusion with Russia in the 2016 elections. How do these things stand side by side?
Well, I think the FBI investigations are very different. You know, I think what the kind of killing of opponents and or alleged killing of opponents and the repressions and the riot police, what this is all about is Russia maintaining its own, the ruling class maintaining its hold on Russia. You know, Putin is definitely very, very sensitive to, you know, every time there's a slight decrease in his polling numbers, he gets freaked out. There's a real fear that, you know, if something happens to the ruling, if something happens to Putin or to their popularity, the House of Cards could come crumbling down. And so they really pay close attention to their polling numbers.
Jake, we got to stop it right there. We're so grateful to you for coming on today for a minute from Moscow. Jake Rudnitsky with Bloomberg News. And Vladimir Putin's response to bad polling numbers. We saw big protests over the weekend, and we're looking at what they mean. You can join us. Did you get the message from the Russian protesters? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Russians in the streets protesting corruption in the government of Vladimir Putin. You can join us this hour. Did you get the message from the Russian protesters this weekend that they're sick of leaders making themselves billionaires in office? Did you see the tough crackdown in reply? The police dragging Russians through the streets, the arrests. Can you picture life in a system where any real challenge to those in power is pretty harshly put down? What are you thinking about all this against the backdrop of investigations underway in the U.S. about Russian interference in the 2016 presidential elections? Sunday's big anti-corruption march in Moscow, and there were many others in 80 cities around the country. The opposition leader Alexei Navalny was arrested. Protesters surrounded the police bus where they were holding him and chanting, "Release him," in Russian. He might like to run for president in elections next year. Talking with reporters Sunday after his arrest during an anti-corruption protest here, he said there's strong support for his anti-corruption movement, and that's why he should be allowed to run next March for president in Russia.
I think yesterday's events have shown that there is quite a large number of voters in Russia who support the program of a candidate who speaks for the fight against corruption. These people demand political representation, and I strive to be the political representative for those people, and that's why I have the right to run for office.
Joining me right now from Washington is Vladimir Kara-Murza. He's a Russian opposition leader, vice chairman of the pro-democracy movement Open Russia. He says he was poisoned in Moscow in 2015 and again in 2017. He believes it was because of his political activities. He's currently in the U.S. with his family for rehabilitation after the most recent poisoning, apparently, for physical therapy, medical tests. Vladimir Kara-Murza, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
You're watching from abroad at the moment. What did you see in the protests Sunday?
Yes, first of all, I'm very upset that I couldn't be with my colleagues in person in Moscow yesterday. But yes, I do have some some more medical rehabilitation to do, as you mentioned, so I'm going to spend some time here. But these were the biggest protests we've had in the last 5 years. In fact, since the big winter of discontent, the big winter of anti-Putin protests in 2011-2012, and 82 cities and towns across Russia had those protests yesterday, and tens of thousands of people took part. And I think what's most significant about this is the composition, the participants of these rallies. According to various estimates, more than half of those who came out to the streets of Russia yesterday were young people, either college students or even high school kids in many cases. This is the Putin generation. These are the people who were born and raised under Vladimir Putin, and yet he's losing them because, you know, frankly, they're fed up with seeing the same face and the same group of faces on their television screens for their whole life. They're fed up with the egregious corruption, obviously, which was the immediate trigger for the protests, but also with the voicelessness, with the lack of political rights, with the fact that elections don't mean anything, with the censorship, and frankly, with the, you know, with the lack of future, the lack of prospects that this regime is leaving them with. I mean, the Putin regime is robbing the young generation of Russians of our future, and I think this is the real underlying reason for these protests. And I also think, because of this, precisely, that this is only the beginning, what we saw over the past weekend. I think over the next few months and over the next few years, we're going to see much, much more of this protest activity in Russia.
Here's a little more from the documentary by Alexei Navalny about corruption in Russia. Medvedev, the prime minister, he says, can steal so much so openly because Putin does the same, but on a greater scale, because everyone in the government does it, because the judges and the prosecutors and the special services are also doing the same. They're becoming millionaires and billionaires with the help of corruption. I guess nobody really argues with that, Vladimir Kara-Murza, but you also say voicelessness and censorship. Could you just describe, I mean, there are elections coming up, so what do you mean by voicelessness?
Right, well, there were elections in the Soviet Union, and I believe there are elections in North Korea as well. Yeah. If by elections you just count the, you know, the bureaucratic procedure of people coming in and mechanically putting ballots in the boxes. We haven't had a real election in Russia in 17 years, and please don't take my word for it. Just look at the reports by the monitoring organization OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which monitors democratic standards in all member states, including the U.S., by the way. And according to these monitoring organizations, the last time we had something that was at least close to a democratic election was more than 17 years ago. In fact, 17 years ago this past Sunday, March 26, coincidentally, also the day of these protests was also the 17th anniversary of the day Vladimir Putin was elected president of Russia. All elections we've had since then have been heavily manipulated. In many cases, opponents were kept off the ballot, as indeed will be the case with Mr. Navalny, as you just mentioned a few minutes ago. And of course, in terms of the media scene in Russia, in the very early years of his rule, Mr. Putin went after independent media outlets, especially ones with significant reach, especially national television networks, by either shutting them down one by one or seizing them for the state. And in fact, if you look at the Russian media scene today, about 80 or 90% of the media reach is completely controlled by the government. It's the message is the one the government wants you to hear. It's basically propaganda. And if you watched Russian state TV over the last weekend, you wouldn't know that there are tens of thousands of people going out across the country protesting against this regime. So there's this fake media image, a parallel image created by the state propaganda, the Kremlin propaganda, that has very little to do with what's actually happening in the country. And this is what I mean by voicelessness. I mean, in our country, unfortunately, who is in power is not determined by people's votes. It's not determined by elections.
And then there are direct attacks. I mean, many opponents, journalists, have died during the Putin years. You say you were poisoned. Are you sure? And why?
Well, yes, I'm a near miss, and I'm certainly very, very fortunate and very grateful to be here. I mean, it wasn't me who said I was poisoned. That's the official medical diagnosis. It's the phrase is toxic action by an undefined substance, which is, you know, translated from medical language to normal language is poisoning. This was exactly the same picture both times, 2015 and last month, February 2017. Within just a few hours, I went from being completely normal to being in a coma with multiple organ failure, with basically none of the organs working, with the body just shutting down and being on life support, and the symptoms were consistent with poisoning. And in fact, this is what the diagnosis was. And doctors estimated the chance of survival, this is what they told my wife anyway, about 5%. So I'm certainly very, very fortunate and very grateful to be here. Unfortunately, many, many other people, including many of my friends, didn't have even the 5%. I mean, as you know well, a little more than 2 years ago, the leader of the Russian opposition, Boris Nemtsov, former deputy prime minister of Russia, the most prominent political opponent of Mr. Putin, was assassinated, was gunned down just in front of the Kremlin. This was the most brazen political assassination in Russia in decades. And no one has been apprehended or identified in terms of the organizers or masterminds of this crime. There have been the alleged perpetrators on trial, but nothing higher than this. And, if you can assassinate the leader of the opposition in front of the Kremlin, you can pretty much do anything.
What do you think of candidate, now President Trump's positive posture toward Vladimir Putin? Is that all right in terms of statecraft, or is there something wrong there in terms of fundamental politics?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's important to state at the outset that it's only our job to change the situation in Russia and
you
to bring democracy.
You mean Russian's job?
It is the job of Russian citizens and the Russian Democratic Opposition. Yes, I'm a Russian citizen. Mm-hmm. That's why I say this. So this is only a task for us. It's not for Mr. Trump. It's not for Mrs. Merkel. It's not for any other Western leaders or any outside powers. So the Kremlin's propaganda claims that we, again, meaning the Russian opposition, always, you know, ask for Western support or something like this. And this is obviously a lie. We never ask for any kind of political support from Western countries. What we do ask for, and this includes from the U.S. administration, we ask them to be honest about what's happening in Russia, and we ask them to stay true to their own values, to the values that, Western government systems are built on. For example, by, not helping Mr. Putin by pretending that he's a worthy and respectable partner on the world stage, and secondly, and perhaps even more importantly, by not allowing the cronies and operatives and oligarchs connected to the Kremlin, those very same people that Alexei Navalny and others are talking about, using Western countries as havens for the wealth they have looted from the Russian people. I mean, the big difference between what we had in the Soviet times and today, I mean, there are many similarities, right? We have political prisoners in Russia. We have media censorship, as we mentioned. There is a lack of free and fair elections and so on. There's basically an authoritarian political system. But there is one very big difference also, and that is that the Soviet leaders, Soviet Politburo members, didn't stash their money in Western banks. They didn't buy up real estate and yachts and property in Western countries. They didn't send their kids to study in Western schools. Leaders of the current regime and operatives of the current regime do that. And we believe this double standard and this hypocrisy has to stop. And a little more than 4 years ago, the United States passed a groundbreaking law. It was called the Sergei Magnitsky Act, named after a Russian whistleblower who was tortured to death in prison after uncovering an official corruption scheme. And that law provides for a visa ban and asset freeze in the U.S. for those Russian officials involved in human rights abuse. And Boris Nemtsov, the late leader of the Russian opposition, who actively campaigned for this law, and I did as well, we worked together with him on it, he called it the most pro-Russian law in the history of any foreign parliament. That's a direct quote.
That is pushing for clean government.
Absolutely, because it is the law that individually targets those people who abuse the rights of Russian citizens and who plunder the resources of Russian taxpayers. And I think it's those kinds of measures that are based on principle and that are also effective that this is the way forward.
Vladimir Karamurza, please stand by there in Washington. Joining me now in the studio is Alexandra Vakru, Executive Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. She lived and worked in Moscow for a long time, 1992 to 2004. Alexandra Vakru, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Are Russian citizens justified in being out in the streets in large numbers protesting corruption?
Well, it's definitely true that corruption is an enormous problem in Russia and has been for a long time and has been since Soviet times, although Vladimir is right in saying that there's a big difference in terms of where those assets are being stashed now. In terms of whether or not they're justified, I think it's difficult for us to sit back and say that someone should or shouldn't go out on the street. And it's that kind of statement that's gotten administrations in trouble in the past. But it's certainly true that the people who are protesting right now feel that they don't have any influence on the path of the government going forward.
What about the broader critique that Vladimir makes of voicelessness, that is, not a real democracy, and censorship, no real freedom of the press or speech?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I think what we're seeing now is something quite interesting. It's the fragility of the social contract that Putin has put in place. You know, for many years, he said, the 90s were very difficult, very corrupt, very wild. I'm going to bring law and order in exchange for economic security. And for a long time, people were willing to accept this trade-off, that they were having more law and order, they were having more security, and they were having economic growth. But what we've seen since the financial crisis, since Crimea, is that economic growth has slowed. And now people are wondering why it is that they should be supporting a government that can't provide this economic growth on which the stability is predicated.
How should this picture come into focus for American leadership? On the one hand, you have a world stage where the United States could work with Russia on different issues. On the other hand, if you embrace Vladimir Putin too tightly or too warmly, there's seen a kind of endorsement of the whole political scene, which, as Vladimir outlines, is quite starkly in opposition to our ideals and values. So,
well, it comes back to the question of whether or not you need to like or trust the people that you work with. I think if you look back to the Soviet times, even in the Cold War, we met with the Russians. Our military talked to the Russian military. We had a lot of contact on different levels with different levels of government. Right now, that's...
But we were never seen as endorsing Soviet leadership.
That's right. But we were dealing with them. The problem with the Obama administration is that out of... Obama administration, is that out of despair that the reset did not work and that Putin still did things that the Americans did not approve of, we cut all ties away with the Russian government. We ceased bilateral commissions that had been set up. Military-to-military contact has been cut off. And we now have almost no exchanges of regular information with the Russians. And that makes it very difficult to have any kind of relationship. I think that there's a middle ground between endorsing warmly a government and having some kind of relationship with them that allows you to do what you need to do on the world stage.
Has Donald Trump hit that middle ground?
Not yet.
Why? What do you mean? Where is he falling short or not hitting that?
Well, so far we don't really have a coherent Russia policy, in part because of everything that's been happening in terms of the investigations into the Trump ties with the Russians. I think that that's been a big distraction in terms of establishing a policy towards the Russian government by the U.S. government.
Distraction? But if Russia, in fact, interfered in our presidential election, that's a fundamental exercise of democracy. How can investigating that be a distraction?
I don't think it's unnecessary. I don't think it's something that we shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. But I think you can, at the same time, have that investigation and have a foreign policy that deals with Russia as an international actor. And right now, we don't really have that kind of foreign policy.
Vladimir, can we have both? Can we investigate Russian interference and have them as a partner on the world stage?
Well, partner is certainly not the word I would use, but I think it's not about not talking to one government or another. It's about what you're talking to them about. I mean, both the U.S. and Russia, for instance, are members of the OSCE, and the statutes of this organization clearly state, without any shadow of doubt, that matters of human rights, democracy, and rule of law are matters of international concern and are matters of concern to all member states. So when Mr. Putin, Mr. Lavrov, or anybody else says, you know, don't interfere into our internal affairs, they are, well, how to put it politely, they are misspeaking, because human rights, rule of law, and democracy are not matters of internal affairs, and you should be speaking about it. So it's not about not speaking. It's about speaking about important things and being honest and being open. And I think it's also very important to emphasize that these protests that happened over the last weekend, and that I'm certain will continue over the next few months and years, this is a very useful reminder, including a very useful reminder to people in the West and to the Western political leaders, that Russia is not just about Putin and the Putin regime. I mean, Mr. Putin would certainly like the whole world, including the United States, to equate Russia and the current leadership. In fact, Mr. Putin's, one of his closest aides, Vyacheslav Volodin, who was deputy chief of staff at the Kremlin, is now the speaker of the Russian Duma. He was on record a couple of years ago saying, there's no Russia without Putin. That's a direct quote. I mean, there are a few things that I can think of that are more insulting to our country than to say something like this. But this is what they think, and this is what they say. And I think it is very important to appreciate that Russia is not just all about the Putin regime, that Russia has many different voices. It has many different views. And in fact, those youngsters, those college kids and high school students that we're seeing coming out to protest, this is the future of Russia. This is the Russia of tomorrow, the post-Putin Russia. And when devising a strategy of dealing with Russia, you know, be it U.S.-Russia relations or relations between Russia and European Union states, it's important to take this into account. that Mr. Putin's not going to be there forever. And it is important to keep engaged and maintain a dialogue with different people and different voices in Russian society.
This On Point podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russians in the streets protesting corruption in the government of Vladimir Putin. You can join us. Alexandra Vakru is with us from the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Vladimir Karamurza is with us, vice chairman of the pro-democracy Open Russia movement. He's in the States now because he says he was poisoned for the second time. And it was, as you heard, going from normal to coma in a hurry. We'll talk in just a few minutes about the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Nunes, Congressman Nunes, who's under fire for his interaction with the White House, as the Congress is supposed to be investigating Russian interference in the 2015 election. Former Vice President Dick Cheney was talking about exactly that last night in a speech at the Economic Times Global Business Summit in India, said that Russian interference in the 2016 election could be considered an attack on the United States.
There was a very serious effort made by Mr. Putin and his government, his organization, to interfere in major ways with our basic fundamental democratic processes. In some quarters, that would be considered an act of war.
Alexander Vakru, given that concern, pretty deep concern about what happened in the elections, given what we saw this weekend in Russia, how does the U.S., might the U.S. best look very coolly and reasonably at its international interests and potential cooperation with Russia without embracing, endorsing Vladimir Putin, not a democratic leader in any fundamental sense?
Well, I think if you look at how we interact with China, that might be a good model for what we could do with Russia. We don't have to endorse the Communist Party in China in order to do business with them. We don't need to say that we approve of the way that they deal with human rights activists, for example, but we can still have negotiations, we can still have agreements, and we can still move forward. The problem with Russia is that it has touched such a nerve in the United States that we seem unable to have constructive discussions with the Russian government on matters that are in our national interest. And I'm thinking, for example,
you mess with our elections, why shouldn't we be up in arms, hair on fire?
We can be up in arms, but we still have international interests that we could do better with the Russians. We can cooperate on international terrorism. We can deal with Iran more effectively dealing with the Russians. And the question is, do we not want to pursue our international interests?
What's the quid pro quo? If we want that cooperation, are they going to say, well, never mind Crimea, never mind Ukraine? They're actively looking to, I mean, Vladimir Putin has said to sort of displace the West or bust up the West, bust up the EU. Maybe Donald Trump doesn't care, but what about Western values going forward?
No, I think that that's a serious concern. I'm not saying that values don't matter, but I do think that there's a mix between the values that are important to us in driving foreign policy and the things that we want to accomplish in foreign policy. And if we talk about forwarding American interest and having America's interests better defended than they have been, we are going to have to deal with the Russians. We don't have to love them, but we have to deal with them.
Dale in Florence, South Carolina. Dale, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's been 17 years since I talked to you. Last time I was in Idaho.
Wow. Okay.
What a geopolitical talk. I love it. I have a comment. I have friends in Russia, mainly Facebook friends.
Okay.
But I was in Fiji last year for 9 months. I love Fiji. And I met three Russians in Fiji, all of them young people migrating on the road, traveling, trying to get to Australia. And they made it. One took 12 years, an excellent man. His name's Sergei. I have a Russian bricklayer friend in the town of Straspol.
Dale, you're a traveler and a man of many associates, but cut to the chase here. Our time is short. Take us to your point.
The chase is, I'm officially nuts, and I know Donald Trump's nuts, and I know Putin's nuts, and we're going to see the same thing in our country. And if we don't get along with China and Russia with regard to international trade and learn how to do it and assimilate, we're hosed. Have a nice day, Tom.
Dale, I appreciate your call. One more. Jeff in Marysville, Pennsylvania. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, just my comment was, I don't believe that Putin interfered with Trump getting elected, but if he did, I personally would shake Mr. Putin's hand and invite him up to my home for dinner because he kept another antichrist like Hillary Clinton out of office.
Holy smokes, Jeff.
I'm off the air.
Okay. Antichrist, and yeah, shake his hand for if he interfered in American elections. Vladimir, you don't want to be seen as tied up with Western backers. You've got a Russian fight to have over your own politics at home. But you hear the American conversation here about the alleged by the FBI. They're investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election, potential Trump team collusion with that. Can we have a cool, even-handed sort of foreign policy cooperating with Russia? And at the same time, does that mean looking past Russian interference? Does it end up putting us in an embrace of Putin and his politics, which you're struggling with?
Well, first of all, the wording is very important. You said that you have a good relationship with Russia. I hope there's a good relationship, long-term relationship between Russia and America. That's not the same thing as having cozy relations with the Putin regime, again, as we discussed mm-hmm. a few minutes ago. No, I mean, the short answer, I think, no. If history shows us anything, is that making short-term, pragmatic or cynical, call it whatever you want, deals with authoritarian regimes is not the best way forward. We've seen George W. Bush trying to be friendly with Mr. Putin in his famous, looking into his eyes and getting a sense of his soul. We saw the Obama administration attempting a reset of relations with the Putin regime. We know how it ended both times. And I think if there's another attempt at this, it's going to end the same way, because fundamentally there is an underlying divergence of interests between, on the one hand, a democratic system, and on the other hand, a corrupt kleptocratic dictatorship. And in fact, everything that Mr. Putin has been recently doing outside of Russia's borders, he's done inside before. And we've been talking about this for years. Why should a regime that disrespects the rights of its own people, that breaks and violates its own laws and its own constitution, be expected to, abide by international norms or respect the interests of its neighbors or of other countries? And sure enough, with time, as the Putin regime got more and more arrogant and got the idea that it can do whatever it wants, it started acting outside of Russia's borders. And we have seen, of course, in some cases, direct military interference, as happened in Georgia and in Ukraine and with the annexation of Crimea, the first state-to-state territorial annexation in Europe since the Second World War, by the way. And, of course, long before Mr. Putin's regime began interfering with elections in other countries, your own and others, possibly, there's talk about him interfering in the German elections this year. The Kremlin has been very heavily interfering with Russian elections, as we already discussed. I mean, there hasn't been a single free and fair election in Russia, or more or less free and fair, at least, in more than 17 years. So everything they've been doing abroad is a continuation of what they've been doing at home. This external aggression is a direct consequence of the domestic repression that has been happening and increasing. And I think, frankly, if Western countries, Western democracies had taken a more principled stand earlier on, we would not be reaching the excesses we're seeing today. So, no, I don't think there can be a long-term, a genuine cooperation between democracies and an authoritarian kleptocracy that is Mr. Putin's regime.
Vladimir Karamurza, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Alexander Vakru, what are the odds that it's Vladimir Putin again after the election next year, 2018, for another, what is it, 6 or 8 year?
Six.
Six-year term?
100%.
100%. It's pretty amazing to be able to make that forecast a year in advance of the election. but here we are. Alexander Vakhru, Executive Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
In a moment, the latest on calls for House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes to step aside from the panel's investigation of Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. This is On Point. Yesterday, top Democrats called for California Republican and House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes to recuse himself from the probe into Russian interference and potential Trump team collusion in the 2016 election. They say Nunes is too close to President Trump to lead a fair investigation. Yesterday on the Senate floor, New York Democrat Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called on House Speaker Paul Ryan to replace Nunes as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee in order to keep the investigation into that interference credible.
Chairman Nunes is falling down on the job and seems to be more interested in protecting the president than in seeking the truth. You cannot have the person in charge of an impartial investigation be partial to one side. It's an inherent contradiction.
Joining us now from Washington is Emery Huteman, New York Times reporter covering Nunes and the House investigation. Emery, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. The latest I'm seeing is that Devin Nunes is rebuffing calls to step aside. Why would I, is the quote I'm looking at here. What is the latest you know on the Republican Nunes' response to calls for him to recuse himself from the investigation?
Well, at this very moment, I think that's as far as we've gotten. Really, Chairman Nunes doesn't have as much pressure at this moment other than coming from the Democratic side to step down. He kind of covered himself a little bit by going to Speaker Ryan with the information that he had last week that he then briefed the president on. And Speaker Ryan is really the one who can remove him from this post. So at this point, what we've got is that Chairman Nunes is saying, why would I step down? And all he's got so far, which is significant for the investigation but not significant for his post, are Democrats asking him to step down.
Can you walk us back through the events of last week that got people so upset with the chairman?
Certainly. After the hearing on Monday with Director Comey and Admiral Rogers of the NSA, on Wednesday morning, Chairman Nunes came out and addressed the press by himself and said, I've seen new information that indicates that either President Trump or members of his transition team may have been incidentally caught up in what he characterized as legal surveillance of foreign operatives by American spy agencies. His issue, he said, was that there was perhaps improper masking of the names in these intel documents that he had viewed. However, he was the only one on the committee who had viewed that information, and at this point, potentially is the only one who still has viewed. As of yesterday morning, that's what Democrats told me. The problem, of course, is that this is a bipartisan investigation, and he hasn't really let in Democrats to what he's seeing, and potentially even his own members at this point, since about, best we can tell, last Wednesday. There have been some developments since then, including the fact that he decided originally to cancel what was intended to be a public hearing today with Brennan, Clapper, and Yates, saying he wanted to have a closed-door meeting with Comey and Rogers to kind of probe more of the information that they had said during the public meeting last week. Democrats said that he didn't come to them with that decision, and then additionally today he announced, Democrats tell us, and a Republican source has now confirmed to me that he's canceled meetings for at least this hearing today and some meetings for the week.
And the reason last week's developments hit home so much was in part because we understand that he was briefed by some or given information by some intelligence operative on the grounds of the White House. Democrats are saying maybe he was even briefing President Trump at the White House. What do we know about that?
Well, we do know for sure that he briefed President Trump at the White House. He told reporters that was where he was headed last Wednesday, and then he briefed reporters again from the grounds of the White House after his meeting. As far as where the information came from, he's told us he won't tell us who his source is, but the revelation yesterday, which came out of his own office confirming it, was that he went to the White House grounds in order to view this information. Now, this raised some red flags for people who had accused him of potentially working with the White House on this latest development, because there are places where you can view intelligence information in other places in Washington, including at the Capitol. He defended himself last night and said that the Capitol didn't have access to this particular information that he saw, and so the only thing he could do was go to the White House. But the fact is that you can't just call your own meeting at the White House. You have to be escorted by a White House staffer. So that has led to questions of whether it was a White House staffer who gave him the information.
And, of course, this phrase that the Trump team may have been, some of them may have been incidentally caught up in legal surveillance, was useful for the president. It's gave him some kind of cover, or at least he treated that way, for his tweet saying that he'd been tapped, his team at Trump Tower.
Right, right. President Trump said last week that he felt somewhat vindicated, was his quote, by this information. However, Chairman Nunes did make a point to say this doesn't change what I said. I haven't seen any evidence of physical wiretapping of Trump Tower. But it was enough for President Trump to say that he thought that this supported his case and to give him some comfort.
So at this point, Democrats are saying they may, suggesting they may pull out of bipartisan cooperation on this. Where is effective investigation still going on into the facts of what happened last year, Emery?
Well, I would hesitate to say that Democrats are saying they'll pull out of this. They have always kind of waived that option. However, they lose a lot if they pull out of this investigation, not the least of which is access to the evidence that they might see as members of this investigation. However, it does call the future of the investigation into question, because really what this investigation has is its ability to put forth a credible report at the end, which comes out of conducting a neutral inquiry. And you can't conduct a neutral inquiry without cooperation from both sides. And up until about last week, Democrats and Republicans agreed, we're cooperating, this is going well. And now suddenly Chairman Nunes is not consulting his Democratic counterpart, Adam Schiff, and Democrats are saying Nunes should pull himself out of the investigation entirely.
Is there a Senate investigation that could move in if the House investigation effectively crumbles?
There is. I wouldn't say move in. It's already been going on. That's led by Senators Burr and Warner. And they've been conducting their own investigation separately as part of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So there is that investigation as well. And they're moving kind of, I would say, on parallel tracks in some ways. And that can pick up in some ways and provide the congressional, I guess, the congressional perspective on this investigation. However, this fact that this particular investigation is crumbling under partisan problems does not bode well for the future of the investigation, and we'll all be watching the Senate to see where they go from here.
Do you see any movement toward an independent investigation being established, a panel or prosecutor?
Not so far. That would require some cooperation on the part of Democrats and Republicans, and at this point, Democrats are the only ones calling for an independent investigation.
Emery Hudeman, New York Times reporter who's been on this story. Emery, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Good to be with you. Thanks.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Be first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button there. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.